This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Scott McWilliams from McWilliams Wines. How are you, Scott?
G'day, Chris. I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. That g'day tells me all about it. You're an Australian?
Absolutely, mate. Yeah. Don't mention the cricket.
Didn't you guys get hammered by English in cricket?
No, I told you not to mention it.
So I don't follow the cricket too much, but in England, when England finally wins, you can't really miss it.
Exactly.
Okay, so you're from McWilliams Wines.
That's right.
Are you one of the family as well, aren't you?
Yes, Chris, I'm sixth generation.
What's your role there?
I've just stepped out of winemaking, but I've been a winemaker for 18 years. And yeah, that's been my passion. As I got offered a few years ago a director role for the business, I started to focus a little bit more on the business side, mm-hmm. and got a little bit of a taste of what it's like to sell wine as much as making it.
Yeah, the winemakers are involved in selling a lot of wines, running dinners and all that sort of stuff.
Everyone's got a little bit of a sales role, in my opinion, and winemakers especially, whether you know they're treated like rock stars or you know, just trying to sell their wares. Depending on the size of the business, you have to wear many hats.
Yeah. What we're going to talk about today is a wee bit about McWilliams, and maybe have a wee bit of a look at the history of McWilliams as well, because you said you're sixth generation. I think it's 1877 you guys started?
That's correct.
Okay, but just before we get into the sort of the history of it, one of the things about McWilliams, when you go on your website, is you've got a pretty big brand portfolio, haven't you? There's a lot of different wines, and there's a lot of, I wouldn't say weird wines, but to a modern Australian winery, you wouldn't necessarily see. You've got a lot of sort of the old tawny port type wines, etc. as well. So,
absolutely.
Let's just talk a bit. Maybe if we start out back in the eons of time.
Start from the beginning.
1877. What happened there, mate?
So my great-great-great-grandfather, his name was Samuel. Samuel came from County Antrim.
And Irish.
Yes. So we're originally Scottish, moved over to Northern Ireland and then out to Australia. And that was in 1858 that he took a ship called the Morning Light out to Australia, eventually bought a block of land, put a vineyard on it.
And where was that?
That was in a place called Corowa, which is actually a very small town near the city of Albury, which is on the border between New South Wales and Victoria.
Okay.
Not too far from the Rutherglen region.
Yeah.
They don't really grow anything of significance there anymore. But it was his son, John James, or we called him JJ. JJ McWilliam actually took the business and took the vine cuttings from Corowa up to the Riverina.
Yeah.
And the Riverina today is a big name mm-hmm. in wine production for Australia. But great-great-granddad JJ, he pioneered the region. He planted the first vines and built the first winery. So the first vines went in 1913.
Oh, okay. And Riverina, I always think of it sort of as the sort of central, quite hot, irrigated area. There's a lot of bulk wine comes out of there. There's also some pretty interesting wines.
Yeah.
Most people, when you think of it, if you see something that says southeastern Australia, it's coming from Riverina, Riverlands, or was it the Mudgee Irrigation Area or whatever?
Murrumbidgee Irrigation Area. Yeah, is actually is part of the Riverina.
Oh, is it?
And it was that irrigation program that my great-great-grandfather was aware of. So our Hanwood Estate Winery is about 30 minutes drive from the Murrumbidgee River. And so he knew that there was water being pumped from that river. He realized the amount of sunshine hours that we got out there in the Riverina and also the fertility of the soil. So he's got a famous quote. He said that the soil was so fertile that if he could plant a six-inch nail, water it in a year, he'd grow it into a crowbar. So it is a fruit bowl of Australia. There's not just grapes growing there. There's all sorts of other industries, primary industries, and it is a great place for growing produce in general.
Okay, and a lot of the river comes from Snowy Mountain, is that right?
Correct, yes.
Yeah, okay, so if you think about Australia, you're sort of heading south, New South Wales, and you hit a load of hills and things, and there's mountains. Well, I don't know if they're mountains, but there's snow up there anyway, isn't there?
Yeah, so most people who've been out to Sydney would be familiar with the Blue Mountains.
That's right.
And the Blue Mountains is part of the Great Dividing Range, mm-hmm. and which is sort of a range that travels north-south from Victoria through to Queensland. So
yeah.
The riverine is just on the western side. And so anything from the Snowy Mountain scheme that flows west is coming through Murrumbidgee River or the Murray River and things like that. And so that's where a lot of us get our water from.
Mm-hmm. Like, I know that further down the river towards Adelaide, there was a lot of issues with saliency. You had, you know, quite a few drought years, all that sort of stuff, you know, with the salt water was working its way back up the river, and it was quite a problem. Is that sort of thing resolved? Or
No, I wouldn't say it's resolved, but it's definitely being focused upon.
And how's the water supply for you guys?
Look, we're fortunate enough to have been in the area to secure water security licenses, you know, decades ago. So water is a very essential part of growing grapes.
Yeah.
And so it's important to have that security, especially in the Riverina. Mm-hmm. The Riverina produces about 22% of Australia's wine.
Yeah.
And like you alluded to before, it's there's ranging from bulk wine, but there is some very high-end specialty wines, and in particular, Botrytis Semillon.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about that later on.
Yep.
So when you JJ, if you like, first went out there, what sort of things was he growing, and what was being made? What year are we up to? Up to what?
First winery was built in 1917.
Okay.
And the original grapes planted in 1913, the variety is Doradillo.
What?
Yeah.
Which one? Oradillo?
Doradillo.
Doradillo.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it produces really big berries, really humongous bunches. We've still got a few of those original vines, just sort of ornamental. But, you know, back then, a lot of the varieties planted were varieties made for fortified production because at that time, Australians only drank fortified products. And so that's what McWilliams Wines.
Same in New Zealand, though. I was out in New Zealand talking to Esk Valley. They were owned by Villa Maria, and they used to be a big port production as well, you know, or port style wines, fortified wines. So New Zealand, Australia, all that sort of stuff, even South Africa still has quite a big fortified history, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, if you ask a older generation Australian, do you know McWilliams Wines? A lot of them will say, yes, it's known for things like cream sherry. If you ask a
not in the EU, because you can't call it sherry in the EU.
That's correct. We call it a pera now.
Is that what that is?
Yeah.
I was on your website. I was going, what is this, a pera?
Yes, I know. And it took a long time to think of names. That was an interesting process to swap out names like port and sherry.
Yeah.
You know, but Australians, well, that's all we drank, you know, and McWilliams Wines built an empire based on fortified production. Decades ago, last century, we were one of Australia's largest family-owned wine businesses. And, you know, that was all based on our bread and butter being fortified wines, which is about 20% of what we still do today.
Yeah, that's what I got the impression on your website, which is unusual. It is unusual. Is that just because of brand loyalty just keeps going and going and going? Or
there's still a market for it, albeit a dying market, pardon the pun.
The older people, is what you're saying.
literally, it's a declining market, but it's still big volume for us.
But there are some pretty fairly good premium fortified wines. I'm thinking of Rutherglen. You know, they make some really nice fortified wines that are fairly premium, or that, yeah, from a quality point of view at least. Do you do that sort of thing? Or
yeah, we do entry level through to premium and super premium in our fortified range.
Yeah,
and some of this stuff like super premium is very, very small volume, available only at the cellar door at the winery. Mm-hmm. You know, it's generally from a Solera system, which is, you know, mainly decades of stock, but it's usually one or two barrels only.
Yeah, okay. Just before we move on, you said a pera for sherries. What are the other names that Australians are using for their fortifieds? Because I'm not aware of the names.
Yeah, so pera is in fact a shortening of aperitif.
Yeah.
And you can imagine trying to find a name to replace sherry. And so it was a really tricky task, and it took them quite a number of years. And you mentioned Rutherglen before. Rutherglen industry was heavily involved in this decision. So port is now just termed tawny.
Yeah.
Yeah. But whilst there's two main styles of port, it's hard to distinguish between a vintage. So it's more called vintage tawny versus sweet tawny. Okay. Yeah.
And is it all tawny styles of port, or do you do sort of more of a ruby style and vintage ports?
Mostly just tawny port and vintage port.
And is vintage a vintage tawny style, or is it like a normal vintage port style?
Occasionally we've done both.
Okay, you just call it tawny. Tawny just means port now in Australia.
Yeah, a little bit that way. It's still a little confusing. topake. Is the third one. So topake being coming from Tokay or Tokai. So, interesting names, but, you know, we respect the wishes of the EU for us to not use those terms. And likewise, we would hate for somebody to start claiming they were making, a Coonawarra wine from South America. It just doesn't feel right. So we respect that, and we've gone through the extensive process of changing the product names.
Okay, so going back to the history, we'll just go back there. It's going to keep going back and forth and back and forth. So JJ set up a business, a lot of fortified wines, and bread and butter. Was it just focused on Riverlands at the stage?
At that stage, it was. We had three wineries in the area of Riverina. There's a city called Griffith where I was born and brought up. And so JJ had four sons and four daughters. The four daughters got given some cash and said, go have a nice life. The four sons got an equal share of the business. And so three of the four sons stayed local, and the fourth went to Sydney. And so the local production had to be split into three different properties because there was three different families coming from those three sons.
Yeah.
And then the fourth was in Sydney tasked with head office and sales and marketing. Mm-hmm. So we had three production sites all within about 20 miles from each, you know, within each other. So, but back then it was all horse and cart. There's no trucks for transport.
Yeah,
so it made sense back then to actually have the all the multiple sites. The three production family arms then eventually, it was quite successful. And we were doing a lot of distillation as well. So we're making brandies, we're making spirit for our own fortification processes. Back then it was a lot cheaper to use some of our byproducts from the winemaking process to turn into alcohol or spirit, as we
call it. What, like a grappa or?
Well, we'd just make it into a high strength alcohol, and then we would use that spirit to fortify new batches and things like that, which is a great outlet these days for winemakers. If there's any mistakes in the winery, you just distill it back to its alcohol form and reuse it.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't happen so much anymore these days. Yeah. Winemakers are not allowed to make mistakes like
that. Is that when you got out of being winemaker? Or?
No, I didn't know it because I'm making a mistake. I think maybe my mistake was getting out of winemaking and having a go at sales. I mean, my dad's always said it's easy to make and hard to sell, and gosh, is he right?
Yeah. No, that's true, isn't it? It's like any business, even our wine tasting business. The hard bit is getting the customer. Running the event's the easy bit. It's always getting the customer is the hard bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So the four brothers generated the four families, which are the primary owners of McWilliams Wines. Mm-hmm. Today, we're still a family-run, family-owned company, which lasting six generations, 141 years. That's a bloody good effort, in my opinion.
Yeah, how many in the family now?
Look, there's a pretty broad family tree, as you can imagine.
Say, yeah.
We've got about five family members working within the business, including myself, and five family sitting on the board of directors. Yeah. So, a lot of family involved. I'd say over 150, but very little interaction and control within and on the business. I'm the only family member wearing the family name with a winemaking degree. And so I I get pushed out into do the events and talk about the wines. You know, sometimes people want to know a bit more about just the story behind the wine. They want to talk about pH levels or skin contact. And, you know, I can quite easily do that too. But, the thing that I love about my family business is the story, which I'm telling you now.
Cool. Okay, so you got through... When did you start really getting into still wines? Or did you... Because you've also got vineyard sites in New South Wales. Which came first, the still wines or the different sites?
So it's a really interesting story, and I'm glad you asked, Chris, because it's where we started to branch out into the Hunter Valley. And so McWilliams was being quite successful selling a lot of fortified wines, but we had a long route to market. Sydney was our major market. Mm-hmm. So back then, to get the product from the Riverina to Sydney, which today is a six-hour drive, back then it was difficult. So route to market was tricky, and we also needed to, I guess, evolve a little bit as a business and start looking at still wine, because still wine was starting to make a bit of a presence then.
When was this?
Well, McWilliams bought a 50% share in the very prestigious Mount Pleasant estate in 1932.
It's been a long ownership, hasn't it? Is it, do you own it fully now? Or?
We do. We bought... So this is another story, perhaps for another chat. The Morris O'Shea story. Because Morris O'Shea started Mount Pleasant, and he was today celebrated as you know, one of the greatest winemakers to have ever lived, and possibly Australia's most celebrated winemaker within the industry. Mm. So Morris was making wines out of Mount Pleasant. Brilliant winemaker. Apparently didn't make any money. And so McWilliams was looking to diversify and evolve. And Hunter Valley was route to market was better for us.
Yeah.
And Morris needed cash in the business. So we bought 50% of his business in 1932. And then in 1941, bought the rest. Kept Morris on, obviously. We expanded the vineyards just as the war finished in 1946. Extensive plantings there. And then our McWilliams journey into still wine, that's when it really started. So in the 40s and the 50s. And then under the McWilliam brand, back at the Hamwood Estate in the Riverina, was more the late 50s, early 60s is when the still wine revolution really started.
Was that because the tastes in Australia had changed at that point, or was it a export type of thing?
No. Look, I've been told the reason for fortified wine being the primary drink of choice back over 100 years ago was purely because those wines would be highly preserved.
And they
would withstand long distance. If it was coming from Mediterranean, you needed high alcohol to last the journey. Much like the same story of IPA beer, you know, it just withstood the journey. So that's what made it to the market, and that's what was drunk. We then saw still wine starting to make its way from Europe and other areas, and so there was a little bit more attention coming from within the industry. So winemakers who had traveled, like Morris O'Shea back in the early 20s when he started Mount Pleasant. So it was even before that he traveled to Bordeaux and he learned how to make still wines. And so the winemakers who had the luxury of travel had come back to Australia and were starting to do these styles on the side. You know, obviously a great story that Max Schubert has about making Grange on the side. You know, it was back when fortifieds were still the primary business strategies for a lot of wine companies.
Yeah.
But the still wine revolution was definitely coming.
Okay. So you had two sites, Hunter Valley and Riverland.
Riverina.
Yeah. Just quickly, what's the difference between Riverlands and Riverina?
So they are separate regions. Yeah. There's probably a good three-hour drive between the two. Yeah. They're very similar in size, and the production is very much similar in offering.
Yeah. And Riverlands is closer to Victoria, isn't it? Not Victoria, to Adelaide.
Yeah, well, yes, it is closer to Adelaide from Griffith, but it's probably another 3 or 4 hours drive from Riverland down to Adelaide.
Yes.
It's sort of in that little corner of where New South Wales meets Victoria meets South Australia, and it's quite a large area, and they do a lot of bulk product.
Probably the better way to describe it is further downstream.
Further downstream, that's exactly right. Technically correct. We call both regions big rivers. The big rivers regions are the real engine room of the Australian wine industry.
Yeah.
And McWilliams Wines, you know, being very proud of being the pioneers of one of those engine rooms.
Okay. So what sort of wines, when you started out with your still wines, what sort of wines were you producing? You know, was it the classic Hunter Valley Semillon? Were you doing all the Shirazes? What were you, you know, what were you having a crack at in Riverlands?
Well, in the Hunter Valley, Maurice O'Shea was making dry whites and dry reds, and he was blending a lot. He was also very well known for buying wine from other wine makers and blending. It was known as a master blender. But in the Riverina, which is about an 8-hour drive today from the Hunter Valley. In the Riverina, the dry styles there was more along the lines of your traditional French varieties like Cabernet Sauvignon or Shiraz. They were labeled a little bit differently there. I remember picking up a bottle of wine that my grandfather made in 1965, and it was called Claret. And I said, "Granddad, what's in it?" And he said, "Look, it's just a whole mix of red varieties, really." And I said, "Well, you used to make one you'd call Burgundy, because back then we would use those terms." And he said, "Yeah, I know, but that was also a mix. We didn't grow a lot of Pinot Noir, obviously." And I said, "Oh, okay. So why did you call them that?" And he said, "It was more of a style indication. So Claret was heavier, Burgundy was a bit lighter." But I think the Australian public just didn't really know the difference. Because he told me a funny story of how claret sales started to wane a little bit. And so he said, "Oh, well, let's just change the name to Burgundy then." And then sales picked up. So. Yeah. Nice. But definitely in terms of style, the reds were quite low in alcohol compared to what they are today. So we're talking about 12%.
Picking a lot earlier, was it, or
I think,
or
just? I think it was also a
bit of viticulture.
Yeah, slightly different viticulture, slightly different picking times, but still also maybe not an efficient conversion of sugar to alcohol from wild yeasts back then. You know, that's got to be taken into consideration too. That there was different yeasts being used. Some of the wines are still living today. Unfortunately, you know, they're all under cork. But when you get a good one where the cork is good, the wines are still looking fantastic. So a lot of winemakers get asked, you know, what's that one wine that made you go, "Oh, I think I like doing this." For me, it was a 1968 McWilliams Hanwood Estate Cabernet Sauvignon. And I had that wine about 2 years into my wine journey.
Yeah.
Interestingly. Yeah. Most people say that they had that wine that took them into that pathway, but I was already on that pathway. And then, and then I had that wine and my granddad made it with one of my great uncles. And I thought it was fantastic. And then I was thinking, as I was drinking, you know, the history and how hard it was to make wine back then. And the fact that this 40-year-old wine, it was 40 years then when I had it, it was still looking really good. And that's what really sort of gave me that light bulb moment of, yeah, you know what, this is really cool. This is really what I want to do. And I really started to respect what the previous generations were able to achieve.
Excellent. All right, Scott, I think we're going to stop here and we'll pick it up next week. All right?
Perfect. Thanks, Chris.
Cheers, mate.